Ken Lax, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 23rd of September 2012. Ken Lax, Part 1.
Ken Lax, I wintered at Halley Bay. I was born on September the 24th, 1946. And I went to Halley Bay I left the UK in 1973. And I wintered at Halley in 74, 75. Then I went back again and wintered in 77.
So you're going to be 66 tomorrow?
Yep.
Indeed. Not retired yet?
No, still going strong.
Tell me a bit about your background. What was your father?
My father was an army officer, so as children we travelled around the world with him. I can recall I was born in Aldershot, which is a military town, and soon after that we moved to Berkshire. And then I spent my early years in Kingston-on-Thames in Surrey, and in a short while in Stockton-on-Tees, when my father was posted there. Then in 1952, we went to Libya, and we lived in Libya from end of 52 to 56. Then we came home from Libya, and we were stationed in... I can't remember where we... No, we came back to the UK, and then we went to Germany. Then I went to prep school and public school in England, and my father went on to serve in Kenya and Christmas Island, which were unaccompanied postings. So we stayed at home in the UK with relatives either in Surrey or in Liverpool. And, of course, I was at boarding school then, so I used to just go home once a year to see the family. And then after that, I went to college. It was called a CAT in those days, College of Advanced Technology, sort of somewhere between a tech college and a university. And I studied marine radio, radar, electronics, sonar, that kind of stuff. And I was pretty hard up. My parents were overseas. I was pretty skint. So as soon as I got my qualifications, I went to sea. And I couldn't go deep sea, which is what I wanted to do, because the Suez Canal was shut and the international merchant shipping was all closed down. So I was at college in Hull, and I managed to get on a trawler sailing out of Grimsby. I'd never been to sea before, and I got myself to Grimsby and jumped on this ship and sailed off to Iceland, which was a sort of baptism by fire, because as well as being terribly seasick, until we got to the fishing grounds and then seasick on the way back, I had to learn how to operate all the things I'd learnt about without the benefit of any apprenticeship or training.
What was it that drew you to going to the sea?
I don't really know. It may well have been because my favourite uncle had been in the sea during the war. That may have been it. But I just wanted a sense of adventure, and I can remember thinking that I might join the Army or the Air Force or the Royal Navy, because obviously coming from a military background, it didn't seem a huge step for me to do that. And when I searched around, I realised that I could be a radio officer in the Merchant Navy, but I would have to join the Royal Navy as a non-commissioned officer or something of that equivalent. So I thought, well, I may as well take the easy route and go straight in. And that's what I did. But as there were no merchant ships available, I went on the trawlers. And I did that for a few years, almost all out of Grimsby, on what we called the freshers, as opposed to the freezers. And we went to Greenland, Iceland, Bear Island, Novaya Zemlya, those kind of places. And then after a while, I went on a freezer trawler. The freshers used to stay away about 3 weeks and come back for 3 days and go away for 3 weeks. And the freezer used to go away for months on end. And I went on that and went to Newfoundland and Greenland. And I did that for just one trip, which was, I think, probably turned out to be about 3 or 4 months, I think. And then when I came back, I thought that I ought to spread my wings a bit. The canal was then open. So I went what we call freelance, and I was given a job on a Greek tanker, Liberian registered Greek tanker, which I joined in Southampton, a place called Forley. I remember taking the train down to Southampton and getting on this tanker, which was a very, very nice ship with midships accommodation for the radio officer. And, of course, after the trawlers, it was huge. The trawlers I was on were, the very biggest was 1,000 tonnes, and this tanker was 50,000 tonnes. So I had a huge radio room and a huge suite for my accommodation instead of a tiny shared bunk room. And I remember getting on board and thinking, well, this would be interesting to see where we go. I had no idea where it was going. And as we sailed, I set up all the radios and got the message to say, go to Bahrain and wait for orders. And the Suez Canal was still not fully functional, so we went by Cape Town, which was quite a long haul. So we sailed all the way there. And after about 3 days, I realised the only word I had in common with anybody was omelette, the only thing that was the same in English and Greek that I'd found. So I thought, right, I better learn some Greek. So I went back to my school days, because when I was at prep school, when we first arrived, they gave us a little blank notebook, a bit less than A5 size. And I remember saying, what's this? They said, it's your vocab book. And I looked at it. I said, well, there's nothing in it. I said, no, you have to write on the left-hand side 5 words in Latin, and on the right-hand side 5 words in French. You can choose whichever words you like, but you have to learn those. And at any time of the day or night, during prep or during the normal day, any teacher can come and take your vocab book and quiz you on any of the words, so you have to learn them. So every day I learnt 5 words in Latin and 5 words in French. Of course, you never remember them all, but after a month you've theoretically got, 150 words, and then you might remember half of them, so you've got 75. But the next month, you're up to 300, and you might remember half, which is 150. So it's a jolly clever way of doing it, because you pick your own words that interest you. Because I thought, well, I said, they're mugs, these people. I went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, dog, cat, horse, and that sort of stuff. But you start to struggle after a while, and it really stretches you. So when I was on the Greek ship, I did exactly the same thing. I just did 5 words a day. Well, after about 6 months, I was pretty well fluent in Greek, written and spoken. So life got a lot easier after that. And I stayed on that ship for about 2 years. I didn't come home at all. We went all around the world, all around the Americas, a lot of time in the Far East, which I enjoyed very much. And then eventually I left the ship because a school friend of mine was getting married, and he'd sent me a telegram to say he was getting married, and I'd always promised to be at his wedding. So I left the ship after 2 years, which is rather sad in many ways, but time goes on. And I left that and I came back to the UK, went to his wedding, stayed a month or so, and then I joined a German company. And I worked on basically fairly old tankers. This particular company had a process of buying new ships and crewing them with different nationalities. And when the ships were pretty well run down, they would put the Germans on board, because the Germans, with their Deutsche Ordnung, would get all the machinery working again and so on and so forth. And I became part of that team, so I went to do the radio side of it. And again, I was the only English person on board. They were either Germans or Filipinos, German officers and technicians and engineers and Filipino crew. And I stayed with that firm for quite a long time. And I joined a ship in Singapore. We went all around the Far East, got tied up a bit in the Vietnam War, because we were running aviation turbines to the Americans in Vietnam, but we were fudging the bills of lading to say that we were going to Yokohama. So we would load up with jet fuel and then tiptoe into Vietnam at night, discharge to some American lighters, and then carry on up to Yokohama, discharge a few cupfuls and fudge the documentation to make it look as though it had all been discharged. All terribly
Terribly dangerous.
Terribly dangerous. We did
what
once.
What happened if you'd been caught?
Well, we did once nearly get caught. We were obviously running dark with no lights and no radio silence, and all of a sudden this Aldis light started to flash at us out of the pitch black of the China Sea, and Captain said to me, "You can read this stuff, can't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "What's he saying?" So I had a look, and he said, "He wants to know who you are." I said, "Well, tell him." So I told him, and he said, "Why are you running without lights?" So he said, tell him that there's been a generator failure, and we're working on it." So I did all that. It's all quite laborious on the Aldis light. You have to do each letter in Morse code.
You remember the same technique.
Yes. So I did all that, but I could tell from the way the guy was operating that he was military, because it was very slick and very precise, and it was a huge Aldis, whereas merchant ships normally had a portable Aldis, so it was always a bit shaky when the guy was operating it. So I said to him, "I think this is a military ship." He said, "Well, just tell him that." So I did that, and he said, "We'll send a team of engineers on board to help you fix it." So I translated that to him, and he said, "Christ, we don't want that. Tell him, what can we tell him? What can we tell him?"
I said, "What nationality were they then?"
The people who were signalling.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't clear at that time.
Right.
It was all in English, so and international codes. So I said to the captain, "I wouldn't do that if I were you. I'd just say to him, no need, we've just heard that it's about to be fixed." I said, "And then what you need to do is put some lights on and to steam off." I said, "OK, tell him that, tell him that." So I said all that to them, and he said, "OK, are you sure you don't want us to come and help you?" I said, "No, it's fine, thanks very much." Just then we put on a few flickering lights and then started to steam off. And he said, "Where are you bound?" I said, "Oh, we're going to Yokohama." "What's your cargo?" And I said, "Jet fuel." He said, "Okay." And then I said, "What ship are you?" And he said, "We are the Chinese Navy." And because we had the radar off, but when we switched the radar on, the screen was littered with ships. I mean, we were actually blundering through the whole of the Chinese flotilla on exercises. So anyway, we tootled past them and waited till they gone away, and then we did a U-turn, went back, did our stuff, and carried on. So it was all a bit hairy at the time, but we didn't do that too often. Mostly, it was fairly conventional sort of runs. I stayed on that ship for about 9 months. Then I came home for a short period. Then I joined another ship. I think I joined that one. Might have been somewhere in the Far East as well. Stayed on that for about 9 months. And then they asked me to, while I was on leave, if I would go to Italy, to Trieste, to install some new equipment on a ship that they were gutting and they'd rebuilt. It was the old Carinthia, the old P&O liner Carinthia. And they gutted it and rebuilt it as a luxury liner. And they were installing on board some very fancy new satellite navigation system, Omega navigation system, and a new radio. So I said, "Well, I'm on leave." And they said, "Yes, but it's only a weekend." I said, "Okay, okay." So I went over to Trieste and got on this ship and sorted this out. I'd never seen one before. It was a sat-nav system, but it was huge. It was valve-powered, and it was about 6 foot tall by about 4 feet wide, and it had a room all of its own. Very, very new technology. We did that and the radio system, and we did the sea trials, which were quite difficult because they had a system on board the ship to stop it rolling, a stabilization system where if the ship rolled that way, they pumped water the other way to counterbalance it. And the ship went out and the captain put it to about 14 or 15 knots. And then it did what in nautical terms is known as a U-turn, and he spun it round, but they'd wired up these pumps the wrong way. So instead of compensating, it made it worse. So the ship went over a terrific angle, smashed about, in those days, about 10,000 pounds worth of crockery and did all kinds of damage. So we sorted that out and we went out for trials again. And I was just commissioning the radio equipment. And we were minding our own business in this huge radio room behind the bridge of the ship. And they were busy doing the trials. And we were busy firkling and setting up. And I said to the radio officer there, I said, just press the key down and hold it down while I just fettle this. And he did that. And the ship suddenly changed course. And I didn't think anything of it because of doing all the manoeuvring. And then I said, that's okay. And then the ship carried on. And then we did something else. And he did it again. And the ship changed course. And apparently every time we put this radio power on, it affected the autopilot and then changed course. So we had to sort that out. And eventually it was all done. And I said to the captain, well, it's all done now, I'm off. He said, oh, well, do you know anything about telephone systems? I said, yeah. He said, well, do you think you could fix this? We've got some problems with the telephone exchange. I said, no, I'm going home now. He said, well, look, I'll tell you what, we'll drop you off in Jib if you'll just sort out the telephone system. I said, OK. So we sorted that out. And then just as before we got to Jib, he said, oh, it stopped, OK. So I said, well, OK, I'll do that, but I only know a little bit about televisions, but I'll have a go at fixing the television. Television. I'd fixed the phone, but now it was the television, because this had this fancy new television system, which was, again, quite new then. So I said, but I can't fix it before Jib. He said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to Florida next, so I'll drop you off in Florida, and if you'll just fix the closed-circuit television. So anyway, I went across the Atlantic with them, fixed the television, and then they said, well, we're a radio officer short. Will you stay on? So
you're being reeled in, weren't you?
So in the end, I stayed on for 9 months. We ran up and down the west coast of the States, through the Caribbean and so on. And then eventually I left that and I came home, and my mother said, I thought you were only going for the weekend. But anyway, that was a long trip. And then after that, I got tired. I read an article in a climbing magazine. So I used to do a lot of climbing in North Wales here. And it was called Mountaineering in Grahamland. I forget the name of the author now, Rob somebody. Anyway, it was a FID who'd been to Grahamland, and I thought, this is for me. So I wrote away to Bass, and they said, well, come for an interview. So I went for an interview, and I met this guy, Bill Sloman. And I remembered that Bill Sloman was a guy I'd spoken to on the phone years and years ago during my fishing days when I was on leave, and I'd seen an advertisement for radio operators in the Falkland Islands. And I'd phoned Bill Sloman, and over the course of the phone conversation, I realised that I didn't want to go to the Falklands. It wasn't what I wanted at all. And forgot about it, and I didn't actually tie that in with Bass or FIDS at the time. Anyway, I saw him in Victoria, I think Gillingham Street, they used to have the headquarters.
Right, that's right.
And I had an interview with Bill Sloman and Eric Salmon and a guy called Barry Peters. And I went for this interview to be a GA, to go to Stonington to do dogs and climbing and so on. And during the course of the interview, they kept asking me more and more about radio. I thought, I don't know why they're going on about the radio. But anyway, I answered the questions. And eventually Bill Sloman looked me in the eye and he said, I can get people who can run up Everest in plimsolls, but I can't get radio operators. So I'm afraid I can't offer you the job as a GA, because I can get much better people than you to be GAs, but I'm desperately short of radio people. I said, well, I can get plenty of work doing radio. And I said, I'm not so sure that that's what I want to do, although I do want to go to the Antarctic. And he said, well, I'll make you a deal. He said, you go to Halley Bay for 1 year, and the next year I'll transfer you to Stonington so you can work as a GA. So you can do a year as a radio operator, wireless operator mechanic, whatever they call it, and a year as a GA at Stonington. I said, OK. He said, I'm afraid we can't pay you much in the way of salary. And I remember saying, oh, I didn't know you got paid. I thought you just got your clothes and your food. And that was it. So that must have warmed me to Bill's heart anyway. And off I went to... I was booked then to go to Halley.
Let me just backtrack you slightly before you head off south. I mean, your background, it was perfectly prepared for the Antarctic, wasn't it? You'd you had a military background with your father, so discipline was not going to be a problem. You'd been to a boarding school, sharing dormitories with lots of other men, and you travelled right around the world several times, and you'd also experienced severe winter weather off the east coast of the USA. So, I mean, there was no other kind of job that was perfectly suited for you, was there?
I would have thought so, although you don't think that at the time, but I did feel it was a nice fit. I felt very comfortable about going. I wasn't at all nervous about not being able to repair the equipment or not being able to fulfil my obligations in terms of radio. I was well aware that there were people who were much better mountaineers than I was. I'd done a lot of climbing in the UK and a little bit of alpine experience, but nothing like some of the people who went down.
Why did you want to go to the Antarctic?
I think initially it was the climbing and the sheer rarity of it. As a youth, I had actually read a book called Of Whales and Men. And I wrote to some whaling companies in Sandefjord in Norway to see if I could go down as a radio operator on a whaler to get down to the South Atlantic. That had sort of fired my imagination, and I'd done nothing about it. It had sort of just drifted into the past. And on the trawlers, I'd sailed with a couple of old boys who'd been on the whalers, with Salversons. And it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was a burning passion to go to the Antarctic because of that, but there were these little germs that had been sown, and I was quite interested to go.
So and did you have a romantic notion about it from your childhood? You read Scott and Shackleton and...
No, I didn't. I'd watched the movie The TAE before, and obviously I remember Edmund Hillary going to climbing Everest, and I remember his Antarctic crossing as a child. But I can't say I was motivated by that. I very much wanted to get to the Shackletons. For some reason, I wanted to get to the Shackleton Mountains. I don't know why. And it was one of the things that made me content to go to Halley, because I thought there might be a chance of getting to the Shackletons.
Was that a scientific inspiration or a romantic inspiration?
No, I think it was more just to see them and to climb.
The climbing?
Yeah.
Gene?
I was never a fanatic climber. You may have interviewed a chap called Doug Holden. Mm. Well, he is the epitome of the dedicated climber. He is an extremely good climber, and I've climbed with Doug. Much better than a climber than I was. Climbed at a higher level, consistently higher level than I did. But I wasn't motivated by the same things as he was. But I would like to have got to the Shackletons, and the irony is that years later, when I had the chance, I didn't go because I let the other members of the base go and I stayed behind.
OK, well, let's take you on to the... So is it Southampton you sailed from?
Yes, I sailed from Southampton on the Bransfield. And that was... 73, and the girlfriend I had at the time drove down with me to Southampton. We rented a van and we drove down together, and I loaded my stuff on the Bransfield, and we'd had a fairly heavy session the night before. I was quite hungover, and I said to her, I'm never going to drink again, and she laughed and laughed and laughed. She said, you'll never give up booze. So from the moment I set foot on the Bransfield, I didn't touch a drop of alcohol for 2.5 years. So all the time I was on the Bransfield going down, all the time I was on base, I didn't have a drop of alcohol, not even the rum sauce. I just thought, right, I'll show you. And I didn't have a drop.
Was that a disadvantage socially? Because it's all men together, isn't it? And on Saturday nights, what do? You get the beer out.
I never found it so. People just got used to it. I think in many ways they thought it was a bit more for them, because there was I forget what the ration was, but 2 cans every other day, and it worked out on base. We had a bottle of gin, a bottle of scotch and a bottle of rum a month shared amongst all of us.
And very well informed for somebody who didn't drink.
Well, that was for the first 2.5 years, and I can remember getting back on the boat, because I made some very good friends on the boat, being an ex-Matalo anyway. I volunteered to do a lot of work on the Bransfield. I helped with the guy called John McClure to repair the sonar system that wasn't working on the boat. We fixed that for the radio operator. And I volunteered to help with all the small boat work with the boatman called Pete Holloway. And I did a lot of small boat work in some horrendous seas with him. And it was just, I suppose, because of my background and working on small ships and sailing and so on, I was able to help him out on
so
that.
So your skills as a seaman were identified by the captain of the ship, weren't they?
No, not really. I just volunteered. They just asked, and if you showed any aptitude, the crew were happy to have you there, especially with the boat landings and so on. And I suppose he may have thought that I was a disposable asset, because if anything happened to me, his crew would still be intact. But I also worked as a greaser on board the Bransfield when one of the donkeymen greaser had to be evacuated home. I used to do a watch in the engine room, doing all the greasing and the oiling and so on. And in another phase, I also helped the cook. I used to help him make the bread in the galley and so on. So I developed a close relationship with some of the crew on there, two in particular, who we've kept in touch with up to this day.
And were you also mingling with the FIDs as well?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. I was always with the FIDs. But a lot of them... Well, firstly, it's not a pleasant voyage for somebody who hasn't been to sea before, because the Bransfield was basically a flat-bottom bucket, and it rolled like a pig. It had a terrible motion. And even though I'd long since had my sea legs on much worse ships than that, there were days when even I felt a bit queasy, and some of the crew, you could see that. So the poor old FID, who just fresh out of university, they suffered quite badly. So they were quite happy that there was somebody who was willing to go and do the work on the boat and on the scows and so on.
Who was the captain?
It was originally a guy called Tom Woodfield, and later on it was Stuart Lawrence.
Tom Woodfield took his wife, didn't he?
He did, yes, and that was on the first trip we went down, and quite a shock for many people. She was a very attractive, she wouldn't have had to be attractive, but she was attractive, slim woman, who was very gregarious, but she had a sense of... I was going to say something awful, like she knew her place, but what I meant to say was that she knew the effect she was having on people, and she behaved very well. She was neither in retreat and she wasn't too forward. She maintained a very dignified approach throughout, but she did come to Halibay, which was a shock to them, because they thought all women had a staple in the middle and folded over when you closed the book, you know, because they only had Playboy and things like that. But she was a very nice lady.
So was she the first woman to go to the Halibay base?
I believe she was, yes. I couldn't be sure, because there may have been some women on Russian ships who'd visited the base in the past, but certainly I think she was the first English woman.
So how was that handled then? Because I appreciate you were there arriving with her at the same time, so you didn't know the FIDs on the base.
I didn't see much of that, really, because the relief's a very frenetic time. And we did have one or two problems with the ice cliff collapsing on the boat, and we nearly lost some people. And it was a huge panic for us. It was an awful lot to do. And it was slightly complicated by the fact that on the base we used to have movies, which were the old reel-to-reel movies. And we got our movies from the Royal Navy Film Club, which basically had a lead box with usually three movies in each box, with three reels per movie. And we had the same system on merchant ships, and when you met another merchant ship who was in the same system, you could swap your box with his box and just kept a little tally. Well, in this particular problem was the ones who had wintered over in 73, which were the people we were leaving, there was a reel missing from one of the films. And it was a film called Hannibal Brooks with Oliver Reed in. And the last reel was missing. But they'd watched the first two reels several times, because there weren't enough movies to have a fresh one every week. So inevitably they were repeated. So they'd watched these two reels over and over and over again. And they refused to participate in a part of the relief until they'd seen the third reel. So we gave them the third reel and they watched that, and then we carried on. But we had an awful lot to do, because they had moved from one base to another, the base that was called Grillage Village, now become known as Halley 2, I think. And they'd also built the Armco, which is the one that we were going into. So they had had a hard time of it, keeping the science running, two bases running and so on. And I was pretty occupied with moving the radio whole station over in one fell swoop during the night from the old base to the new base. So there was myself and the radio operator who later went to Adelaide, who eventually married a Falkland Islander and still lives in the Falklands, and another radio guy, and the outgoing radio guy. And we all worked through the night and set the whole thing up and put new aerials up and wired the whole thing up and got it working. And we had our hands full, really. And then on top of that, we had the normal relief with all the boxes coming in and the boxes going out and so on. So I wasn't really aware of Ella's presence during that relief period, I'm afraid.
And I guess very few people were.
I would think they probably weren't aware of her because she was so discreet and so so sensible and so nice. Yeah. She was a thoroughly nice woman, really.
Yeah. Just go back to the collapse of the ice shelf. I mean, I've heard this story from other people, but I'd be interested to any eyewitness account you have of that.
Fortunately, I wasn't there. I was on the base. I saw the damage to the ship, and
which
I
was what?
Just caved in part of the side of the ship, where the top side of the ship, almost like the ship's rail, was all folded over and damaged. And there were some people who had very lucky escapes. They were picked out of the ice. They were just standing on bits of ice in the water, and they were picked up with the crane. So they were jolly lucky. But I missed all of that, I'm afraid.
Would they have had to repair the ship before you could sail back?
No, she just sailed back with this dinge on the side. It was only was right up on the top side of the ship.
Okay. Talk a bit about... But you were the first monitoring team in the new base then.
Yeah.
So you're above ground initially?
No, it was built underground.
It
it was actually built in a trench, and then the trench was backfilled. The idea being to stabilise it. Yeah.
The Armco base number?
I think it would be number 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was originally built in an Armco shell, and inside the shell were wooden huts built on scaffolding and racking. And the idea was that this Armco, being sort of oval shape or more egg-shaped and oblate spheroid sort of shape, that the pressures on it would be equalised and the base wouldn't collapse in the same way that the other base had, where we had huge steel RSJs that were just bent with the sheer weight of the ice and the snow. Because there isn't much precipitation at Halley Bay, but there's a lot of accumulation. And the minute you put anything on the surface, it changes the flow, and you get the wind tails building up, and gradually it just accumulates on top of the base. And we then have to raise the shafts or put an extension on the shaft. That the pain in the neck, really, was the garage, because we had to dig the ramp out. And we tried all kinds of tricks to avoid doing that, but ultimately you just had to dig it out each time.
So this is Big Al Smith's design?
Yes, right? Yes. He had a big hand in it. Basically, it was one long base with a T off where the generator shed was.
So how was it moving into this new experimental base?
Well, of course, we'd never experienced anything else, so we didn't know what it was like at all.
Were there teething troubles?
There were quite a few teething problems. I think the builders had done a fabulous job to do what they'd done, but they'd been a very undisciplined mob, and the quality of the bunk rooms was very variable. And I was lucky enough to get one that had been done by a guy called Torchy, the electrician. And he had a bit of a tiff with the rest of the group, and to work off his anger, he used to go and to his room. So it was absolutely immaculate. It was fitted out beautifully, and the walls were lined with beautiful wood and stained nicely, and it was probably the best bunk room that was there, and I happened to get that. So I was very lucky. Wasn't so lucky when I went back the next time as base commander. I got one of the grotty ones. But they did vary a lot, but they were all unheated. All of the pit rooms, as they were known, were unheated. So you didn't tend to linger there. You you went there to sleep, and then when you got up, you left.
Was there a reason for them to be unheated?
It was partly to try and help with stabilising the base, so you didn't have a lot of heat to dissipate. And it was partly for concerns about fire. Mm. So there was no smoking allowed in the bunk rooms. And, of course, this was in an era when most people smoked. So there was no smoking in the bunk rooms and there was no heating. The other advantage was it did keep people out of, well, some people, out of their beds. But the difficulties that I'd observed during my first 2 years there were that you seemed to have two kind of base commanders at Halley. One just let people get on and do their own thing and let them get up at any old time of the day or night and just do whatever they wanted. And the other were very, very strict, almost with military discipline. And when I went back as BC, I was able to change that insofar as I was very firm with them about when they got up. I made sure everybody got up in the morning and was up during the day and I knew where they were. But I let them have a great deal of latitude to the extent that we always had a lot of other jobs to do around the base that were nobody's job, like digging up the fuel, taking away the rubbish, getting the water, doing the dogs, raising the dumps, that kind of stuff. And in the two experiences I had, one put out a list and said, thou shalt appear at 8 o'clock and do this. And the other one just went and tried to do it himself and would ask people if they'd give him a hand. So after the ship left, I had a meeting with the whole base. I told them what the plans were for the year, what the journeys were and so on, and what the targets were. And I told them that I was going to put up a list of the tasks that needed to be done and ask for volunteers. I'd say what volunteers I wanted, a driver, an electrician or whatever, and I would expect people to volunteer for them. I would be looking at who volunteered, and anybody who didn't volunteer often enough I'd speak to. And if the work didn't get done, if I didn't get enough volunteers, we'd go back to the strict rota of having to do this, that and the other. And I'd never ever had a problem with people volunteering, and they always felt that they had a bit of a say, because one of the worst jobs was chipping away the ice under the huts, because the gap between the huts and the armco was very small and we had to get rid of the accretion of ice. So you had to go down and lay down on your back and under the huts and chip it away and lift it out by bucket. It was a horrid job. And sometimes in the winter we had to do fuel runs in very poor weather, and not everybody liked to do that. So I'd go around and ask, and sometimes they'd say, oh, I don't feel like going out. Can I do the lounge? I'd say, yeah, sure, I'll put you down for the lounge, but perhaps next week I'll put you down for something outside. And they'd say, yeah, that'll be okay. So in a way, they sort of had a say in what they did. And the other major change I made was that we always used to have what we called a Saturday scrub out, which they did on the ship as well. And that was on a Saturday morning. Everybody would be allocated a task and we'd clean the base from top to bottom. And this scrub out was literally a scrub out. So the place was sparkly clean. But because I used to make them get up every morning at 8 o'clock, they complained that they never had any time to themselves. So I said, well, that's okay. Why don't we do the scrub out Friday night? Then you can do whatever you like on Saturday and Sunday. You can stay in bed all day if you like. There's no problem. So they said, OK, we'll do that. But the older lag said it'll never work, it'll never work. But it did, and everybody did what they wanted on the Friday night. The place was done, and then they could do what they wanted on the Saturday and Sunday. And I believe that that tradition has carried on at Halley, and I think it's the only base that does its scrub out on a Friday night instead of the Saturday. But it just suited everybody so that they all felt that they were having some say in what was going on.
So just, again, backtracking slightly, you're obviously learning from the base leaders that you served under. Had you any ambition at that point?
No, not at all. In fact, what had happened was, on our first winter, soon after the ship left, our base commander was a very experienced...
This is Brian Jones.
Brian Jones, yeah. Very experienced GA and climber, and I learned a lot from him, and he taught me my Antarctic field craft. He was a terrific guy. But he distinguished himself very early on by getting lost. You've probably heard the tale. He was the base commander, and I think I'm right in saying he was the first dedicated base commander. Previous to that, the base commander had always been a met man and a base commander, or a GA and a base commander. And he was the sole base commander. And he was helping the met men with the balloon launch and following it on the radar. The radar was a very old ex-RAF tropicalized hand-driven radar, a bit like the old AK-AKS that you moved it by handles and you could change the azimuth and the elevation and so on. And you'd follow the balloon and then you'd get a radar signal and you'd read the coordinates out and somebody would write them down and somebody else would be taking the data from the balloon and he'd say, OK, when it was at this height, at this angle, the pressure was this, the temperature was that. It was very primitive, but it worked. And that was located off to one side of the base. And to get to it, you had to walk through all kinds of things, the vehicle park, the fuel drums, cables, because our cables were above the ice. We put them on wooden stakes and kept them above the ice. And we had one little gap in there where the vehicles went in and out, and there the cables went under the ice and back up. And in the blizzard, Brian missed all of these obstacles and marched straight through this gap and straight away from the base, heading off basically south and east. So when he didn't appear, there was a bit of a panic and we had a look round for him. And he hadn't actually appointed a deputy base commander at that time. Well, there was nobody there really apart from myself with any knowledge of remote knowledge of field craft. I certainly wasn't experienced in Antarctic field craft then. So I organised the search parties, got them all roped up, got them with lights. We put the cloud searchlight pointing upright with lots of things. And we kept a log of what we did while we were looking for him. I got in touch with Stanley and told them what had happened and what we were doing. And they said, yes, you're doing everything right, but don't risk anybody else's life. And we went a day and a night looking for him and we didn't find him. And the next, after the day and the night, the weather eased off and we had a lovely clear day. And we saw this figure walking back towards us. And he'd walked into the geomagnetic stake lines that we had. And they're all numbered. But he didn't know whether they were numbered sequentially, whether they were going up or whether they were decrementing and going back to base. So he didn't know which way to go. So he very sensibly dug a hole in the ice with his hands and just lay down and covered himself up. And luckily, he had a non-FID coat, which was an ex-Canadian Air Force lined three-quarter length coat, which he'd managed to acquire. And that he wrapped around himself and he just stayed in the ice. But he was very close to death. When we got him back, his core temperature was just on the turn. So we just warmed him up very carefully and brought him back. And then after he was recovered, which was very quick because he was a very fit, strong person, he called me into his office. He said, I've got to make Colin the base commander and I'm sorry I can't make you the deputy because you're a new boy and we really need to keep the first year people on our side. And I said, it doesn't bother me. I had no interest at all. So I went through the first year very happily. Then we had a new... during the first year, we heard that Stonington was closing.
I'll come to that in a minute, sorry.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the Ken Brian Jones episode.
Oh, yeah.
What were the feelings on base about that? Was there a sense that he'd been silly and was your respect for him reduced?
Not at all. I can only speak for myself. Yeah. I didn't feel anything about it. I just thought, well, there but for the grace of God. Because how on earth he'd managed to walk through all those obstacles without hitting them is a miracle. When we went out and looked at it again, we thought, the chances were like a million to one, I think, that he could have done it.
But you were fearful that he wasn't going to come back. After a day and a half, you must have been worried.
We were starting to get a bit worried. I thought we'd be looking for a body. Mm. And I didn't want to extend the search to the cliffs because that was the most likely place he would have come to harm, really. They were about, I think, about 60 feet then. So anybody falling over that wouldn't have a snowball in hell's chance. But we were continuing to look, and we went up early in the morning at first light. Well, as soon as the snow stopped, the blizzard stopped, and to look for him again. And we were going to widen our search and use vehicles and go further. But then we saw him, and we picked him up and brought him in.
And you put on a searchlight so that he could find, if he was still up and about, he could find the base
at
night.
We had a thing called a cloud searchlight, which the Met men used. It just went straight up, and then they would measure the height of the cloud base. And it wasn't my idea. It was somebody else on the base, I forget now. And they said, well, let's put the searchlight on. So if he is out there, he might at least see the searchlight. But he didn't ever see it.
Was there any change of practice? Any lessons learned from that episode? I mean, he was out on his own, wasn't he? Which causes...
there were. I think people were a lot more cautious. And we very quickly went into a training routine for the other people. And we encouraged them to go on man-hauling expeditions. Taught them how to put tents up in a blow. Showed them where the emergency stores were. Explained to them that the numbers did actually increment as you went further away from base, and we put up higher markers and so on and so forth. But we didn't change anything much because, I don't know, maybe I was so involved in my own world, but I was never aware of anybody thinking, oh, what a clot, or anything like that. We just thought it just happened, and it could easily happen. So I used to take people out who didn't travel much and say to them, well, just make a footprint in the snow there, and they do that. And in a blizzard, the footprint disappears almost immediately, and they thought, crikey. And they realised then how difficult it would be to find your way back.
Okay. Was it a frustrating year for you, because you really wanted to be a GA, and there wasn't much scope for being a GA at Halley? So were you a frustrated field assistant?
I wasn't at all frustrated, actually, because I developed a routine. Brian showed me how to run the dogs, and I had certain radio skeds I had to keep. They were timed, where we had to send the Met information regularly and scientific reports. So there were certain times of the day when I had to be in the radio room. So I got into a routine of getting up very early and running the dogs before the first sked. So I used to get up at 6, and then I used to run the dogs. And I used to just tie a rope round my waist and ski behind them. And I would drive them down onto the sea ice, down the ramps, onto the sea ice, round to the penguins, right to the edge of the water, and bring them back, and then put them on their spans, and then go and do my radio skeds and do the rest of the day.
So you do that alone?
Yes. I used to do that alone. I used to just leave a note with the Met man and tell him where I was going. But I used to do it alone, which I doubt they'd be allowed to now.
Did you take a radio?
No. No, I just went as I was. I was careful where I went. In the winter time, I ran the dogs as well all through the winter. I used to keep a little tunnel open from the garage ramp up to the top, and I cut some kennels for the dogs in the ice.
That was you, was it?
Yeah.
On your own or with the
team? I think myself and John McClure did it mainly, with a chainsaw, and we cut the kennels into the ice near one of the shafts and brought the dogs in the winter. And I cut 4 kennels, so I used to rotate them round and clean one out and put the other one in. And then I used to get them harnessed up, and I used to ski out of the ramp and go out. But in the winter when it was dark, I never ran them if it was less than minus 40. All the people do, but I didn't. And at first, I used to take a tilly with me. So I'd be skiing behind the dogs with this tilly lamp. And then I realised the dogs could see perfectly well without the tilly lamp, so I stopped taking that. And I used to do a huge circle around the base because I could see the base lights. And I used to do that. And that way I ran the dogs all the year round. And then in the summer, Brian and John McClure and myself, during the winter, we'd made a special lightweight sledge with lightweight sledging boxes and equipment. And we went out in the field with the two dogs and the sledge, unsupported. We took everything with us.
Whose idea was it to create the underground kennels?
I think it's something we'd picked up from Bunny Fuchs' film about TAE. I don't recall any sort of moment when somebody said they ought to build a kennel for them. Somebody said they ought to come in for the winter. And I thought, well, what are we going to do with them? So we built the kennels. But I don't know what they actually did before in the old base. I suppose when they had all the dogs at Halley, I suppose they must have done the same thing. I didn't really think about it. Don't know how it originated, but as I was in charge of the dogs, I took it upon myself to do it with John McClure, and we just got a chainsaw and went ahead and did it.
So your feeling was that the dogs would not have survived the winter on the surface?
I felt they probably would have, but I thought it was an unnecessary burden, because in the kennels, the temperature would have been about minus 20, because once you get that deep under the ice and you cut a hole in the ice, the temperature there is at more or less the average temperature of what it is topside. So it would have been about minus 20, so it wasn't overly hot or overly cold for them. So they were all right. But in the field, I've been out with the dogs in cold weather and bad weather, and they just curl up and seem to survive.
You were looking forward to going to Stonington for your second year, and then this radio message arrived. Yes. Do you remember what it said?
It said it was a general message to all the bases, saying something like, "This is the last winter at Stonington. It's going to be closed, and a new base will be built at Rotherhithe."
You were on a promise, weren't you?
I was indeed. Yes, I was quite angry about it, and I can remember saying to Brian Jones, "Aren't you cross about it?" And he said, "Well, no, you seem more angry about it than I am." Because he used to tell me all about Stonington and all the run-up, the soda bread and all that sort of stuff. And I was looking forward to going. And then this came, I would think, somewhere in the winter, deep in the winter. It wasn't at the beginning or the end. So, and I remember being a bit aggrieved. And then I thought, well, actually, I like it here very much. So I wasn't worried, because I'd built my own little life. I had the two dogs, and I did a lot of miles with them. I did more than 500 miles one year with them, which is more than a lot of people have the pleasure of doing. And because it's just the two dogs, you have to do a lot more of the work yourself. And I was really quite happy. By then I trained the doctor to do the radio, some of the radio work. So I was able to go away for extended periods, and he was able to run the radio station for me. He enjoyed doing that. And in fact, I did it with both doctors, with Tom Pierce in the first year and with Eric Harvey in the second year. And the interesting thing is that both of them went on to be radio hams as a result of their experience on the radio. But they were very good, and it gave me time to get out. And I spent a lot of time in the field some years.
So did it occur to you that Fitz might have known when you were being interviewed that Stonington was about to be closed?
I always had the fear that Bill Sloman knew exactly that what was going on. Yeah, but I didn't really care, because when I came to the end of my second year, I told them I'd like to stay for a third year. I didn't want to go home. I still had things to do. And Dick Laws was the director then, and he'd come down to Halley, and he was talking to me. And I said, well, I'd like to stay for a third year. And he said, well, we've got an operator. I said, that's OK, I can stay as a GA and so on. And he said, well, we'd actually like you to come back to the UK and help us prepare, and then come back to Halley as BC. I said, yeah, I don't mind doing that. And that's how it happened. I didn't have any inkling or anything like that.
Were you surprised to go?
I was, yes, but I would have gone back as cook, really. I wasn't too bothered. So I wasn't really expecting it. I wasn't expecting it at all, and I wasn't really aware of the burden that comes with being a BC.
Let's come to that shortly. Why was it so good? What was so great about being in the Antarctic at Halley?
Well, Halley was just a fabulous place to me, because it was everything you wanted it to be, and you could do whatever you wanted. It was a can-do sort of place. So, for instance, I was always terrible at DIY and carpentry, so I used to help the builder a lot, Jack Temple, who passed away last year, year before last. And I was his lad. So in between skeds, I would always help Jack because I wanted to learn about that sort of stuff. And I spent a lot of time with him, and he taught me a lot about woodwork and carpentry. Still not much good at it, but everything I did, I learned from Jack. And I was just very, very happy to do it. And then in the mornings when you went up and you looked out at the ice, and you could see what you wanted in it. It was so beautiful, the colours of the in the ice and the snow. And if you ever go inside a crevasse, the colours inside the crevasse are just so wonderful. And when you took the dogs and you went up the hinge zone onto the polar plateau, when you got up there to a little depot called Crossroads, you could just look south and you think there's nothing there. And once or twice I was up there and I saw a mirage of the Shackleton Mountains, or maybe they were the Therons, I don't know, but we saw a mirage of the mountains, and it just was so wonderful. And you could be up there and you could look out at the frozen seas and the skies, and in the night time there was the aurora to see. It was just fabulous to be out there and to just to witness it all and be part of it. And I never ever tired of it. Every morning, 6 o'clock, I used to be out there, even if it was blowing quite hard. If I felt I could still see where I was going, I'd go out with the dogs and give them a good run.
A couple of quick questions. Were you doing radio ham work yourself?
I did very little, actually. I should have done a lot more, because I know that there are radio hams who are keen to get these contacts. And I was a licensed radio ham myself, but I never actually did very much.
That suggests that you weren't that worried about being in contact with the rest of the planet.
No, not at all. In fact, I can tell you that I did not listen to the BBC News for 12 months. I listened to it on Christmas Day, and I listened to it on the next Christmas Day, and I didn't listen at all in between. I used to listen on the shortwave occasionally to the Swiss radio, and I can remember once being up about halfway up the hinge zone, and we were camped, and we used to take a little transistor radio with us with shortwave on it, and I picked up Radio Luxembourg, which I thought was an ionospheric freak, but we actually picked up Radio Luxembourg. But other than
Jimmy Savile, Pete Murray.
Yes, it was Pete Murray and his cat. No, who's it? Had a cat? Somebody had a cat. I don't know. But yes, we picked up a bit of Radio Luxembourg for a while. But I didn't do a lot of radio hamming. I did mostly in Morse rather than on the phone. There were plenty of people who did, but not, I didn't.
Another quick question for me. Was the old base completely abandoned, or was it still being used for anything?
It was still being used. I used to go over there quite a lot, and we stored quite a bit of stuff over there. And in fact, when I went back as base commander, rather than store all the food in dumps outside, I stored it in the old base because it was much easier to get at and so on and so forth. And we used it for storage until I left. We still used it for storage. It was collapsing still, but we had all of our foodstuffs in there, some radio spares and that sort of stuff. So it was still used, and people used to go over there sometimes just for something to do, go and have a poke around.
A bit of a garden shed, you mean?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. And we actually ran power over there from the Jenny Shed, so there was electrical power over there. We just had a little switch in the Jenny Shed with a board, so if anybody was over there, they could say that they'd gone over, so we'd know where they were. And, of course, it was the source of Ian Levac's accident, where he hurt himself very badly.
Who's
there.
Back?
Ian Levac, the doctor. He.
Can you tell me the story of that?
Yeah, Ian Levac was the doctor on the year I was BC. Scottish guy, extremely tough. He was a member of the SAS as a territorial, and has only just retired from that. He's done several tours at Camp Bastion, and as we speak, he's on Tristan da Cunha doing a six-month stint with his wife as a doctor. He's retired now from the NHS. And one of his tricks, because I used the old base as a storage place, I kept the shaft open, and it had a gantry with a rope that went all the way down the shaft, so you could hook something on at the bottom, then you hook the other end of the rope onto a vehicle, the vehicle reverses, it comes up, then you swing it round, put it on the sledge. And I saw him in the summer leap onto this rope and abseil down. And I said to him, don't do that in the winter because the ice will form and the friction won't melt the ice. It'll just freeze straight away and you'll go down like a rocket. OK, Chief, he said. Well, one day I was going to my bunk room and his bunk room was opposite mine. And I heard this groan. He said, Chief, is that you? I said, yeah. He said, what's the matter? He said, I fell down in the old base. I said, oh, how did you do that? He said, I fell down the ladder. I said, how far did you fall? He said, all the way. Well, I knew then he couldn't have done that because the ladders went down in stages. You went down like that to a stage, then you went down like that to another stage. So I said, did you abseil down? He said, yeah. And he rocketed down and landed on his bottom. Well, it was about, I would say, maybe 40 feet or more. And prior to that, the day before, they'd stored some Dexium lengths there. And they, rather than lower it all down, they just threw them down into the snow at the bottom. So they were at the bottom like a bamboo spikes at the bottom of an elephant trap. And he missed those, luckily. But he crushed his vertebra. His knee had gone up and blacked his eye and damaged his nose a bit. So we had to look after him. It was far too late for any rescue. Mm. And he was very, very strong and very compos mentis. We had an old X-ray machine there, which we got working. And one of the guys, Andy Quinn, who was a geophysicist, I think was a frustrated doctor. So he took a large role in organising the X-rays, taking them and then showing them to Ian so that Ian could look at them and say what he thought it was. We were in touch with the Stanley doctor by radio, but not much help he could do. And Ian cured himself. He did a lot of exercises every day, a little bit more, a little bit more. And then he got to the point where he could actually jump off a paperback book. And he jumped off the book, and that was a huge step forward. Then he jumped off bigger books, and then he jumped off rungs of ladders. And he was doing a lot of exercise. And then by the time the summer came, he was able to go off on a jolly and have some time in the field. But if it had been a weaker person, we would have been in serious problems. But he was the major problem that we had in terms of injuries, and that was all due to that. We still keep in touch with him. In fact, he was the best man at our wedding, and I still see him quite often. And
how's his back?
He's a little bit shorter than he was, but since then he's run marathons, and he's back in the TA. He was in Serbia several times. I think he did two or three tours at Camp Bastion in Afghanistan. Mm. He was a consultant anaesthetologist at a teaching hospital in Dundee before he retired. So he went on to do great things, and he had the most unpopular experiment on base. So part of his medical research was to drive a person to exhaustion and see how long it took. So he had a bike that we had to ride, and we were connected up, so all of the everything we exhaled, all the oxygen content was analysed. And the definition of exhaustion, I think, I'm not a medical man, is that when you can't get enough oxygen into your body anymore. So he had this bicycle with different weights on that were called, I think, kilopons or kilopascals or something. They put the force in, and they became known as kilopillocks. And you started off riding it fairly easily, and it got more and more till it got to the maximum. And there were very few people who actually managed to get to the maximum. I never ever did. But at the end of all the research, he analysed each person to see who'd become more fit and who'd become less fit. And out of everybody, I was the person who'd become more fit, which was a tribute to how unfit I was, I think, when I went down. But he also used to measure the subcutaneous fat on the FIDs. Mm. And he got very frustrated with the fact that he couldn't always be sure of measuring it in the same place. So he put a stitch through everybody, so we all had a big black stitch, so we knew exactly where he could take his measurements. It was voluntary. There were two or three of them who didn't participate, but everybody else did. But he was the only guy who badly hurt himself.
Let's take a pause and reconvene.
Right.